a man in an orange t-shirt and khaki pants who appears to be flying. These sculptures are two of the many self-portraits of multimedia artist Jonathan Borofsky, whose retrospective opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Borofsky has described his work as revealing the inner world of dreams and the outer world of politics, and the sounds and images of both worlds collide in this ambitious installation. Paintings and sketches are hung on the walls, sculptures hang from the ceiling, mechanized figures about 10 feet high stand on the floor, a neon sculpture is strung across the room, and small speakers within the sculptures emit the sounds of gongs, mantras, babies crying, and sirens, and these sounds fill the room. Recurring themes run through Borofsky's work, and some of them have become trademarks, like his Chattering Man sculpture, which is a life-sized wooden figure whose mechanized jaw constantly moves up and down, and from a tape loop inside come the words chatter, 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 chatter. His ping-pong table piece has appeared in various forms in several of his shows. At the museum, a real ping-pong table is painted over. One side is labeled U.S., the other side USSR. Across the table is written, "For Defense, 1984, wasted in fear of one another, $300 billion. Two paddles and a ball are on the table, and museum-goers are invited to play. And there's his dream paintings, which illustrate both fanciful and threatening imagery. The paintings are captioned. One reads, "I dreamed that a Hitler-type person was not allowing everyone to roller skate in public places." Borofsky is also known for his self-portraits. He doesn't sign his name on his pieces, he numbers them, and this is part of an ongoing piece that he started in 1969 when he decided to count from zero through infinity as a form of meditation. And every day he spent several hours counting from where he left off the day before. He still does this, but not quite as much. He writes the numbers he counts on graph paper, and when he completes a piece, instead of signing it, he gives it the number that he's up to in his counting. The graph paper that he counts on is now stacked several feet high and stands in the Philadelphia Museum of Art retrospective. Art critics have raved about his recent New York shows. Critic Barbara Rose wrote, quote, "Borofsky has brought back vitality, spontaneity, and creative personal expression. Indeed, he appears to be the one artist able to make something positive and life-affirming out of the essentially negative anti-art ephemeral style of the 70s, like narrative art, body art, conceptual art, and process art." Borofsky was born in 1942 in the outskirts of Boston. He completed his first oil painting at the age of 8, and that painting is in this retrospective. He received his MFA from the Yale School of Art and Architecture. His work has been shown around the world. The Philadelphia Museum of Art retrospective will travel to the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. You can see the show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art from this Sunday, October 7th through December 2nd. Jonathan Borofsky, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did you ever consider being anything but an artist?
Yes, I think when I was younger, an artist was one possibility, but I think I called it the four A's. It was an artist, an archaeologist, an astronomer, and an architect. They all seemed like appealing possibilities. Ironically enough, I feel a little of all of those possibilities enter into my work now.
Why did art win out over the others?
Why did it? I seem to have fallen into it naturally. I think it was something I could do in school rather readily, whereas you couldn't really study archaeology too early on in high school or whatever. So it was something I did in high school, and when it came time to apply to college, it was something I still did fairly well, and it was one of the ways to get into college was to be able to do something well.
A lot of your art is very introspective about dreams and psychology and your inner thoughts, which... But some of your art is also political, reflecting on the outside world. Have you thought a lot about what function you'd like your art to have in the lives of people who come to see it in galleries?
Yes. First of all, I would like the work to communicate to the people who come to the let's say the museum in this case. I would hate to feel that people come and shake their heads and walk out receiving no information whatsoever. So the whole, and this is true for every artist, no doubt. Every artist or every human being likes to be able to communicate some of their ideas to others. So I'm no different in that respect. These last few years, I've made a greater effort to make my own work more accessible to a larger audience. Hopefully this is the case in this kind of an exhibition. It's not like you have to lower the level of the intellect or lower the level of the poetry. It's just making the words a little clearer or a little more precise, or the sentences a little more open to people.
One of the things that a lot of people know about you is the fact that you've been counting since 1969. How did that start?
The counting began as an outgrowth of one year of me just sitting down and thinking about things, life, the universe. This 1 year of what I called thinking came after many years of making paintings and sculptures and art objects. And I began to just take a different tack in my work and to try something very different. And it just meant sitting for a while and wondering why it was I was doing what I was doing, thinking more and doing less, making less. So this thinking began to take the form of many pages of written material, diagrams, thoughts about myself and the world. And out of that came a lot of numbering and systems that I began to use to help to describe my thoughts about the world, geometry, dimensions in space, whatever. That focus on mathematics began to lead me to a further dimension, which was just wanting to simplify my thought even further to one simple activity, one almost simple-minded thought activity, and that was counting. I decided that the year of thought that I had was not really bringing me too much further than it had already, and I wanted to simplify my thought down to an almost zen-like activity. So I decided to challenge myself with this idea of just beginning with the number one and counting onwards and upwards for as long as I could, with the idea, I had this gut feeling that if I continued it for a period of time, it would teach me something. I wasn't quite sure what it would teach me, but if I could stick to it for a while, it would tell me something or lead me to a new place in my work. So I began counting these numbers on graph paper, as you said, day after day, when I felt like it. There was no regimen to it. And it was fairly obsessive at first. I got right into it, very excited by the possibility of doing something so different and unique, and yet almost absurd at the same time. I had already been involved with studying Beckett or Ionesco and the theater of the absurd in an earlier point in my life, and there was something of the absurd which I enjoyed. At the same time, it seemed rather meaningful. It seemed to tune me into the idea of time and the repetitiveness of time.
You said you'd count when you felt like it. I mean, what's that feeling like it? When would you wake up and say, "Boy, well, I really feel like counting today"?
There's always the urge to continue to make art, to continue to proceed in your life, to do something. And so every day I have this urge to do something, and in this case, now the form was counting. So I might wake up and have a normal breakfast or something. At one point I had a dog, and I would walk the dog and come in and sit down to work and pick a comfortable chair and put the pad of paper on my lap and begin to count for a couple hours. I might get tired after that and do something else, go for a walk or listen to some music or do something entirely, nothing to do with art, let's say. And then later in the day, I might come back to 2 or 3 hours more, maybe an hour at night. Later, it became a little looser with the focus of it. At the beginning, I was very obsessed to the point of wanting to keep it quiet, and later I began to just do it watching television or anything else that I happened to be doing. It didn't have to be kind of this obsessive, closed-off activity. I began to make the analogy to somebody sitting in front of the television and knitting or doing needlepoint or something. It was just an activity, only it was a mind activity. Instead of working with my two hands and a ball of yarn, it seemed to occupy my mind. It can push me forward, and again, it had a sort of simplicity to it, and I knew every day what I had to do. I just had to pick up with the number I left off the day before.
I was telling a friend about your work, and he told me that in the movie The Prisoner, starring Alec Guinness, that Guinness, while in prison, counts to keep from going crazy, and mm-hmm. that's a technique, apparently, that's been used by other prisoners of war mm-hmm. as well. Do you think that you were doing it to keep from going crazy?
Well, I think that, I don't know if it was from going crazy, but I think it might have been to, I remember not knowing quite what else to do and having an inkling that if I did this, it would lead me somewhere, that it was something to do, that it did give me the mind some focus and activity. Of course, there are other focuses on counting. Some people, count to go to sleep, or they count sheep, or we know in Zen Eastern religions there are certain meditations that lead around counting from 1 to 10 over and over, or other mantras. So of course there are other, quite often it's used to still the mind in some religions. So this would relate to the idea of keeping from going crazy. If you don't still the mind, your mind is going to be jabbering on.
Well, did it lead somewhere? Did you get the kind of breakthrough or change that you were hoping would happen after counting a lot?
Well, I feel, as you know, I'm still counting, so I feel that it has led me to new ideas and a greater breadth of ideas since I began. For one thing, after a couple of years, I found that this obsession with counting was not enough, that it was too one-sided part of the brain for me. Another part of the brain was not the part of me that was more intuitive, that had more feelings, that wanted to splash a little paint on the canvas once in a while, or just express myself more freely, was not getting that. Was not having that possibility. I was just day after day putting these digits into graph paper squares, and so I began on these pages that I was counting on to scribble every once in a while. After an hour of counting, I found just naturally that I began to scribble on the pages as well. And I referred to it as scribbling. So then it became counting and scribbling. And the scribbling sometimes took the form of stick figures or figures running around in fields or whatever, just whatever came to mind. It was just to let the hand travel on the page, usually with a Bic ballpoint pen, and do things that I wasn't allowed to do up to then, or I hadn't allowed myself to do. Well, this began to loosen up that other part of me that had been kept at bay for a couple of years while I did this pure conceptual activity. And soon I felt the urge to take one of these scribbles, which I enjoyed very much, a head attached to a tree and a little figure way in the background in a landscape in front of some mountains and a sun behind it. I felt the urge to paint that. So I went out and, like a child, when I was 8 years old, when I did my first oil painting, I went out and got an oil painting kit, which I had given up all my paints and stuff for those few years, and even, I used to work on large canvases when I was in graduate school. All of that had been given up. But I went out again and got a little canvas board and an oil painting set, which seemed I wasn't making a big commitment. I just felt this urge to make this little painting. And in an afternoon, I made this painting of this head attached to this tree, and wasn't quite sure why. I just had the urge to do that. And I set it up against the wall in my apartment on the floor. And again, another natural urge came. I looked at my counting, which was sort of piled over in another part of the room, and I went over to the counting and took the number that I had left off on in the counting that day, which was around 800,000 and something at that point, and put it on the corner of the painting that I had made, normally where one signs their signature. And it only later did it, maybe a week or two later, I began to realize the implications of that act, that I could now continue the counting, which I still enjoyed and didn't want to give up. And at the same time, I now had reopened up this image-making door of mine, which had been closed for a while I focused on the more conceptual side. And I could reopen up that door and still keep the conceptual side alive and bring the two together almost symbolically at different points to for a full energy for myself to now to use both sides of my brain, both the intuitive and the emotional, the side that's attracted to dreams and to politics, everything that's going on in my life that's emotional, and at the same time the other side of me, which is attracted to the purity of the Zen garden, the perfect line, the Brancusi bird in space, these an idea of a perfect clarity, rigid structure that we all have in our life and need, whether it's a phone number or a Visa card number or a social security number or a license plate number. These are all necessities, and there's a certain purity to this. It gives us a clarity in our life. It gets us through our lives so that we don't bump into each other too often on the streets or cross paths without necessity. So I could keep that structure, and at the same time, I felt free again to bring back my emotional intuitive side.
Speaking with artist Jonathan Borofsky in his retrospective Open Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, what number are you up to now?
Recently, the number 2,907,978, somewhere in that, 979, 80. I count very little now in the style that I did at the beginning. It's been how many years, 69, 79, 14 years or something. What began as an obsession on paper has now shifted ground. I'm much more into making images and recording my psychological observations of both myself and the planet at large. And the numbers have taken a more balanced place and less obsessive place. I count, sometimes I don't even put them on paper recently. I just count them in my head. And occasional, I might not count for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. I might have feel like I've given up counting entirely. And just when I make something, just remember the last number I was on and put that on the object. So something has slowly shifted. That obsession has found a balance and almost gone to the other extreme, where I'm making an awful lot of images and letting out an awful lot of feeling these days.
Now that you're so identified with counting, can you stop if you want to? Can you start signing your name instead of putting numbers on paintings if you want to?
That's an interesting question, which I have thought about. I don't see why not. I don't feel like one should be frozen into any position one's whole life. You have to remain free to keep pushing onward. And if I felt, I think it's maybe happening naturally. I've been aware of that, that slowly the counting is phasing itself out of my life. But something no doubt will replace it, because it has reflected my need for a conceptual basis to my work, a conceptual structure that I want to still retain. The counting might not be the what is necessary now to reflect that need for structure. I might hopefully progress to a new higher structure for myself.
How did you make a living during the years when you were spending most of your time counting and you weren't really producing much art?
Mm-hmm. I was teaching then, and it was a younger period when even if I was producing our paintings and potentially saleable objects, I wouldn't be selling those either, because I wasn't connected with the gallery and I was fairly much in retreat at that period of my life in New York City. So I was teaching in an art school, School of Visual Arts in New York City, and that pays the rent.
It seems that you wanted counting to fulfill some kind of spiritual function in your life. Have you ever been religious?
I don't feel that I've been too connected with the traditional religions.
What religion were you brought up in?
Jewish. Both parents are Jewish, grandparents, etc. I was raised in the Jewish tradition in a very loose way, I would say, until the age of 13, but I still was bar mitzvahed like every good Jewish boy should be. From that point on, I was kind of released from any obligations to that religion and felt I still feel it's interesting to know that I've come from this structure or this religion in my past, but I'm much more attracted now and have been for the last 15 or 20 years to all religions and how they relate to each other and what are the simultaneous parts that make us all the same, and whether it's Buddha, Mohammed, Jesus, whoever the leaders are of the, why they exist, why do these religions exist, what do they have in common, what do we all have in common, so my religion now is hopefully takes in all religions in a sense, and I think of it as more of a humanism, if anything else.
You have a recurring sculpture that you use called the Chattering Man. Do you want to describe it?
Well, that's a gray, it's painted gray at the moment, these figures, and they're about 7 feet high, and they're cut out of wood, and they stand three-dimensionally on the floor. They have a motorized mouth that has a motor that's been placed into the brain area of these figures that moves a light balsa wood mouth that's been covered with aluminum to look rather slick and mechanical. And underneath that moving jaw that's going up and down via this motor and electricity is a little speaker that's been set into the mouth. And I have tape players that are hidden behind different parts of the walls in the museum that are playing, in this case, in this show, chatter, chatter, chatter. It's my voice that's been recorded several times and overlaid. Chatter, 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 chatter. Referring to the chatter, both in my mind and from the people I've spoken to, the chatter that goes on in everybody's mind, whether it's walking down the street or sitting down at a table or whatever it is, talking over your day's activities, somebody who irritated you yesterday, some problem you have to worry about tomorrow, your work, your love life, whatever it is, the fact that the mind is continuously moving and discussing things. And what I and I'm sure other people have observed, is that quite a bit of it seems to be rather wasteful, at least on my part. Some of it is good for preparation for something that's happening. You have to prepare for things or discuss things with yourself. And then other chatter seems to be entirely wasteful, if not detrimental. It seems to sap energy because you're just going over and over, I'm going over and over in my mind, things that it's not going to help me to go over and over this particular subject anymore. It's better to just let it go. It will take care of itself, or it's a worry, or it's a fear. And so I'm basically using these figures to refer to the chatter that I've been well aware of in my mind over the years, the chatter that Eastern religions refer to when they talk about using meditation to quiet the talking of the mind.
Did counting muffle that chatter?
I think it was a way of taking the chatter, the thought, the year of thinking that I had done, and bringing it down to one point, trying to focus it down to one word, one mantra. And so it was in the tradition of Eastern religions, which I wasn't aware of at that time. Somebody only later said, hey, that's a lot like Zen counting. Why don't you look into Eastern religions, in which case I did become very involved for a while with what that was about, the quieting of the mind and the awareness that the mind is talking quite a bit. And in fact, if it is talking quite a bit, then maybe it's not allowing itself to receive as much information. The old phrase, if you'll shut up for a minute and listen, maybe you'll learn something. This began to become apparent to me. If I could, in fact, quiet my mind while I was walking through the woods, I began to see things in the trees that I wasn't seeing at all if I was talking about something that was about to happen tomorrow to myself.
Speaking with Jonathan Borofsky, who's retrospective exhibition opens this Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. You have a lot of paintings on the show that are your dreams, and they're captioned with what your dream is about, and the painting is some of the imagery of that dream. Do you think you dream a lot? Do you think you dream more than most other people who you know?
No, I have a feeling I'm somewhere in the middle. I know people who can remember their dreams every morning when they wake up. I know people who say they never remember their dreams. And I sometimes remember my dreams. However, when I first began to focus on dreams as one way to make art and record some psychological states of mind for myself, I did begin to remember dreams almost nightly for a period of a year or two there, and that was an intense focus on dreams alone for my artwork.
What made you turn to your dreams as material for your art?
As an artist, a creator, one is always looking for new ways to do your work, new ways that will be beneficial both for me and for the outside world, potentially. And it seemed like this was an area, a territory that had been touched on by the surrealists in one sense, the idea of dreamlike imagery, and yet hadn't been taken as far as I had the idea to take it, which was to be more direct with my dreams, to simply write down in narrative form exactly what I remembered the night before, whether it was as personal as something that took place with a girlfriend or my mother or father, specific direct moments that I remembered from, and putting that down onto paper first and possibly later, if it seemed important, putting it onto canvas. So, yeah.
Have you ever been in analysis?
This period where I began the dreams did also link up with a period where I wasn't in analysis, but I did meet with a group of people and an older lady who was the leader of the group, who had a somewhat spiritual base to her teachings, but also a rather Jungian, Freudian base as well. And people would come, maybe six people in the group, and sit down and meet in her apartment, and somebody would always have a problem on their mind from the week's activity. And they would throw out that problem to the group and say, this is what's bothering me and this. And slowly the other people in the group would ask questions and start to try to help this person get to the root of what the problem might be, the root of the anxiety. So this period of did coincide up with the use of dreams in the work, the psychological implications.
You have one dream about you and your mother being in a supermarket in a strange town. Can you describe that dream for us?
Well, it's the dream is in two parts. The first three canvases describe my mother and I being chased by little gangsters with guns who are chasing us down the street. And those canvases are painted rather darkly and grayly. And at one point, we finally, for safety, run into the supermarket. And at that point, the canvases suddenly become light and more airy and free of this darkness. So we get into the supermarket, and for a moment, we run out the back door. trying to even go further because we think these people are about to come into the supermarket. And then we actually encounter these gangsters out the back door, so we come back into the supermarket where the dream ends. It might not sound too profound over radio or even... it had a great deal of meaning for me at the time, and it seemed important. It was really a dream that's laid out the way my life was going. Certainly, becoming aware of my fears, learning to become clearer about what they were, escaping into a supermarket, which symbolically for me is always, supermarket is the 20th century conclusion to a hunt for me. Where the hunter would go out and find food, and you have survived your day's activity. You will now have food for another night and food for the family around the fire. Well, the supermarket is our conclusion of that. And so no doubt this, I would always make connections like this in the dream. And it's hard for me, I guess, to analyze it right now with you, what it meant. But it seemed archetypally that it was a type of dream that other people were having at one time or another, being chased through the streets of some place by someone that you were fearful of, looking for safety, looking for a form of enlightenment or freedom. So it seemed important for me to enlarge this dream onto a canvas or a series of canvases and at the same time present it to others to see and say, hey, do you have dreams like this too? Or
Does everybody tell you their dreams now?
Not too often, although... occasionally somebody will approach me with that. I remember in my first show where I showed these dreams in 75 in New York, what was most interesting or sort of felt good was to have people come up and say, well, after seeing your show, I really started to remember my dreams now. Now, I don't claim that dreams are the answer to our problems or my problems to remember them or whatever. I just find them interesting. I feel like I'm just a student of the mind, and I like to approach it even rather naively. I'm just a student of the mind, and here is something that I notice the mind doing at night while it's sleeping, and I'm interested in recording some of this information to find out what the heck's going on here and whether it's worth anything. I can't even claim that it's worth anything, although I have found some interesting information coming to me through dreams.
Well, it seems, in fact, you've gotten some artistic direction from some of your dreams. For instance, you had a dream that a Hitler-type person was not allowing everyone to roller skate in public places. Now, how did you interpret that in terms of your art?
Well, that was the first part of the dream. Then I decided to assassinate this Hitler-type person because he wasn't allowing people to roller skate. But my friends told me that Hitler had been dead a long time. So when I realized that, I realized that maybe I should just go into politics. And that seemed like a good idea because I was tired of making art and I was wondering what to do with the last half of my life. So that's how that dream went. And at the time that I had it, again, it implies, if I have to get too personal here, a certain fear that I might be carrying through my genes, through my life from another period of time. But it also symbolizes anybody who tries to control another person or control another country, one country controlling another, a Hitler-type country, a Hitler-type person, anybody who tries to place demands on somebody else, especially against their will. That I was slowly becoming free of that, although I still had an anxiety about it, and it was keeping people from roller skating or myself from being free, which I had the dream when I lived in Venice, by the way, where there's quite a bit of roller skating on the beach there, symbolizing... you're having a good time along the beach. And in fact, the last part of the dream talks about going into politics as a way about speaking out, speaking your mind, and helping to free not only yourself but freeing others by speaking your mind. And my work has become more political after that dream. I have begun to state my feelings, my ideas through my work, and hence the dream had a fair amount of prophecy about it.
Another dream that seemed to provide artistic direction was that you dreamt that Salvador Dali wrote you a letter. You want to describe that letter and how that affected your work?
I'll see if I can remember the wording now. Yes, I did. And it went, "Dear John, there is very little difference between the commonplace and the avant-garde. Yours truly, Salvador Dali." And I just remember those words coming to me in the dream. And it's not that profound, but at the same time, it's really saying, we know what avant-garde is. It's supposed to be very way out, hard to understand, the furthest way out that art can go, and usually very few people can understand it. And at the same time, This dream is saying that the commonplace, the everyday that we are aware of, is also almost equal to that, if not the same. And so it just makes one think, how can that be, and how can I make that clear in my work?
So how did your work change after that?
Well, I can't say that my work changed specifically after having that dream.
Were you less interested in making avant-garde statements?
I can't say that. I'm still interested in exploring new territory, which a good avant-gardist is. You're always looking to explore and say something in a new way that hasn't been said before. But at the same time, I want to make it accessible and reachable to an audience, communicatable. And in that sense, to the that's possibly what the dream relates to make it common, to reach the common people with it, rather than to keep it to kind of elite and select for a few people who are focused entirely on the art process.
What do you think about now when you look back at your early art? And there's, for instance, a painting that you did when you were 8 that's at the Philadelphia Museum of Art now.
Well, of course, that painting that is put under the age 8 is part of a large piece that I did when I was 30 years old, 11 years ago, and that's the only reason it's there. Even though this is sort of a retrospective, this is one piece that takes work from different ages in my life, starting with my first oil painting when I was 8, taking another painting when I was 14, a sculpture when I was 18, sculpture when I was 21, sculpture when I was 24, right up to the present. And the idea of the piece, and it was an idea, was to show that my life reflected through my art was continuously changing, no doubt would continuously go on changing, and that I wanted to show this, that it was, that I just wasn't making one style of work or doing one kind of work as an artist, that I had always moved through different styles of work. And yet, at the same time, I felt that it was all one, that it was all me, that it was, even though they were different, that it was still all me. Hence, the piece is really called Age Piece, All is One. And so there were all these different kinds of work reflecting different periods of my life when I had different styles going on. And yet, I've pulled them together onto one wall, put the age over each, and called it one work. And that had fairly significant spiritual implications as well as just educational implications for both myself and hopefully other people.
Who saved the painting from when you were 8?
Well, my mother would tend to save most of my work, herself being an architect, trained as an architect, and also a painter, had a fair reason to keep work and knowing the potential value of any artwork, not that it's precious, but that it's a shame to throw anything out if you can keep it. So there were certain works, there were plenty of works that I'm sure my mother and myself have thrown out over the years, but all I was looking for was one work to symbolize that particular period, and this work happened to be the first painting that was great. For age 14, there are several paintings still left in the basement from that period, and I picked the one that was most representative of that period, etc. Yeah.
Even away thumbed your nose at what's stylish, but on the other hand, you've become stylish now. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's not so much that I thumb my nose at it. I find it confining for myself to be frozen into one style or to be labeled one style of artist, and that would not feel good to me. So I would make sure that doesn't happen if possible. It's more that attitude rather.
You're living in California now. You live, I think, in Venice part of the time and then in the mountains part of the time?
Mostly now in Venice, yeah, although I did spend a lot of time with my girlfriend in the mountains. But right now, I'm mostly in Venice.
Do you intentionally want to be away from the New York art world?
Well, I think it started out to be intentional, but not the idea that it would be a long-term division. I had been in New York for 11 years teaching and working, and suddenly I'd had my first show in New York and had a fair amount of success, but more important, had felt that I now had a gallery where I could come back every year and a half and do a show if I wanted to. Hence, one of the reasons you go to New York is to find some place where you can get an outlet to speak your mind or have a gallery in the case of an artist. So having nailed that down and also receiving an offer to go teach out in California for 1 year, it seemed very enticing to go to this very strange part of the world to me, being an Easterner. And So I took up the idea for a year that I would come back after that year, and I just haven't returned yet. I'm still out there for 7 years. But part of the idea was also to get away from New York. All that 11 years of New York had meant to me, I just wanted something new.
Do you feel like you've ever been part of a school of art, like conceptual art?
There was a moment when I was lumped with some conceptual artists in the late 60s, but I really wasn't aware that there was such a thing going on, frankly, and I just, I no doubt was picking up the energy through my skin pores, though, because there I was writing my my pages of information, just like a lot of other people, both in England and America. But I don't think the museum here has written a bit about my history as you enter the show, and they've attempted to use the word new image and neo-expressionism to try to give a direction to where my work is at the moment. I would prefer using none of those words, but it does help to try to label somebody for the moment so that you can understand where they fit in historically. As I said, I'm more involved with trying to keep myself moving with the idea that I might learn more under those circumstances.
In a tour that you were giving guards and tour guides yesterday, you referred to some of your work as part of your ugly period. What did you mean by that?
Well, that was around age, well, I did some work around 22, was it? And then again at 24, that lamp that is representative of that period. Well, that really came when I moved to New York City, that lamp. I stopped making much more personal work, which were a series of works about a camp I had gone to as a child. And they were very personal, kind of fragile pieces for me. And I think the influence of the big city hit me as soon as I moved there, and it was like an instant marketplace. The marketplace for everything was, I just felt the energy there. It's the marketplace for clothes, for food, for art, for any, you name it. There's the place practically on the planet. That's one of the key places, centers of energy for that. So I was walking up and down the Bowery quite a bit where I lived, near the Bowery, and there were many lamp stores there, and I began to become infatuated with the styles of different lamps that people had in their windows, and some seemed to be more aimed at the Puerto Ricans that were living in the city, and some seemed to be more aimed at the Italians, and some seemed to be more, there were almost styles of lamps, or some more for the rich people, some more whatever. It was all kinds of styles of lamps, and I had made lamps at different times in my life, and I began to make a series of lamps and other decorator objects that I was calling, they were art, but at the same time, they were functional. And this particular lamp that I referred to the guards, was what I called my Spanish Pavilion Cubist lamp. And it was made in the Cubist style with a lot of different facets of forms and stuff. At the same time, seemed to relate to a lot of the lamps that were being aimed at the Spanish population in New York at the time. I copied some of the gold leaf that was being used quite frequently. The style of the lampshade, I tried to copy some of the styles that were in these lamp stores. And I wasn't that attracted to the style, and therefore I called it ugly. It was not my taste. At the same time, I didn't mean to ridicule it as much as to say, look, there are different kinds of, there are different styles. Again, I was referring to this idea that there are different ways of making work and different ways of making lamps, for that matter. But it was that particular lamp wasn't one that I would have in my house, except under the guise of a work of art, you know.
Well, what would you have in your house? How would you describe your taste in your home?
Well, right now I live in my studio, so it's not really... I had an apartment for a while, which I just gave up, and I need to find another one to separate out a little my living circumstance from my studio. So at the moment, I feel like I'm in transition. And my studio is rather large and white and clean and has a nice skylight and was used as a gallery before I got it, so it has a kind of crispness to it that I'm very fond of. But I really can be comfortable in any kind of circumstances, old funky furniture or new Swedish, Danish design. I kind of like all different kinds of things. I have none of it at the moment. It's mostly a studio with a few chairs and a table for food and a mattress thrown on a desk until I can now get a new apartment.
Have you ever gone through a period of rebellion in your work where you are either rebelling against your own past or against your family past or art history's past or your teacher's past, anything like that?
Well, I would assume that I would like to think that I'm always rebellious in the sense that you're always pushing the given norm a little, that you're always hoping to take what has been established as the way something should be and just taking it a step further, just trying out a new way to do it. And that could be considered rebellious, whether it's hanging a painting sideways or tilting it when everybody knows you should hang them right side up or straight. Or whether you should start counting and call it art when everybody knows that art is making pictures of people or flowers or whatever. There's always been that need to push the limits of what we call art, and therefore I'd like to think I'm always a touch rebellious.
One of your paintings is actually cut in half, and only half the painting is exhibited. Is that part of the rebellion you're talking about?
Not necessarily. I don't feel that's rebellious. I think it's a touch of, it's a little humorous. At the same time, it's a little, it relates to an idea that I've been working with in my work for some time. One of the several ideas or lines that I've had going simultaneously, the thoughts that enter into my work. And this one has to do with things that aren't there as well as things that are here. Objects that we don't see, spaces that between objects rather than the object itself. So occasionally I do a cutout of a man and the man is missing, the cutout of the man is missing, and you just have the space around the figure. Or I have done a series of figures where I drill holes into the figures and call them molecule figures, referring to the molecules in our own body, the pockets of air that actually make up our solid body, that in fact were made up of pockets of a liquid and air, and trying to see things on a more scientific structural level for a moment. And this carried over into this idea of half the painting there, but half the painting not there. And to add to that a little, it's a sailboat in the painting, and the painting cuts right through the sail of the sailboat so that the white of the sail begins to disappear into the white of the wall, adding to that possible illusion. And if you take that even further, I have used sailboats at different times in my life to symbolize sort of a spiritual movement onward. My father enjoys sailing very much. It's one of his obsessions. I've been involved with it just a little, but I still think of the sailboat as a rather nice tool for moving naturally through space, no noise, just the wind. And here I have this sailboat that's suddenly partly there, and then it disappears into the wall, becoming the whole wall itself.
You have one piece in the show. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Jonathan Borofsky, an artist who has a retrospective that opens Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and then travels to the Whitney and the Corcoran Gallery of Art and the Walker Art Center. You have a piece that's basically a lobe and lobe envelope. I think they're an investment company, and on it is some scribbling that you did.
Mm-hmm.
What makes that worthy of being hung in the museum?
Right. Well, you're referring to that drawing, which is hung with many other drawings in a section of the exhibition that are just pushpin to the wall. They're not framed, and they appear to be just scraps of paper on which I have sometimes what appears to be just scribbles or little doodles that one might do on the telephone, which in fact they are. And other times they're a little more serious, and other times they actually look rather like rather good, well-done black and white drawings. And those are the type I tend to do on the beach or when I can slow down and just concentrate in a certain way. The point is I like to take many of my drawings, which ultimately get framed and either sold or put away somewhere and protected with these frames. I like to take them while they're still in their original state and put them up on the wall for people to see in the most direct manner I know how, which is not to frame them, not to put them behind the protective glass and the protective frame that surrounds it to keep it from getting damaged. Well, that's going to happen to them anyhow sooner or later, either while I'm still alive or after I'm dead. But while I'm still right here now at the moment, I have the chance to call the shots as to how my work is going to be seen as long as I still own those drawings. And I say they go on the wall this way. And it does challenge the museum a little because their worry is to protect all these works of art, to make sure people don't touch them or take them. And, of course, a frame and attaching the frame to the wall is certainly going to cut down that potential. But the point is it brings people closer to the work. They can now see the original piece of paper. You can go right up to it with your eyes and see the connection between the piece of paper that I've drawn on and the fact that you have your own scraps of paper on your own desk by your own phone, or that have occasionally a doodle or two yourself. on these scraps of paper. Now, what does that mean? What am I saying? Well, that potentially you all are artists. We all are artists. We just have to allow ourselves to start moving the hand and move it, the pencil across the paper, and you can begin to make images. And then you might find, well, it's interesting, my dealer, Paula Cooper, I always look at her notepad, and she's always doodling while she's on the phone doing business, and they're usually these very structured kinds of doodles. Well, it certainly interests me, and I'm sure it interests her, why she does her kind of doodle, these structures that are constantly linking up and locking together. That reflects a certain inner state of mind. Just like my doodles are reflecting my state of mind, they're very different. They're usually little figures with big ears listening or something like that. They come out kind of intuitively. I don't think about them too often, what I'm going to do. And I kind of enjoy those drawings because they're reflecting a sort of intuitive state of mind. And as I said, I'm a student of the mind. I might study dreams, but I also study other states of mind as well. And these drawings reflect another state of mind.
Do you really believe that everybody could be an artist?
Yes and no. Yes, I think everybody is born with the potential to be anything. And what happens in your life is slowly doors are closed on you, either by the way you've been treated or the way life goes for you. And if you're lucky, one or two doors are kept open and you go through those doors and grab it. And if you're lucky, things go well from there. If you're unlucky, all doors are closed and you're lucky to just hang in there. And I think everybody's born with a creative spirit to just, if they like, to like to make pictures. But those that have the doors closed, well, some of them end up having money. And they can go ahead and come back and buy some of those, bring the art back to themselves by being collectors. They love art, most of them, but can't remember that creative spirit that they might have been born with. It's been slowly worked out of their system. I feel it's there. It's always there. So you find somebody that does it for you.
A couple of your paintings have to do with femininity and masculinity, or being male and being female. One of them is called, I forgot
male
the title.
Male self and female self?
Well, there's that one, yeah. Well, there's a man and a woman having a tug of war, and there's a kind of head sitting on the rope of the tug of war. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, I forget what it's called. You'll remember. But it's a man, perhaps a self-portrait, and in the crotch a very phallic-like missile pistol, and a sports car, and a knife.
And an arrow. It's sort of listed chronologically.
Yeah.
It's a male figure, rather aggressively positioned, standing up, moving forward, and out of the crotch, starting at the bottom, historically, is a club, the first primitive weapon, working their way up to, I believe, a knife. Then we get into the air for missiles. We have an arrow. Then I think it's a gun. And I've slipped in a sports car just as an aside. But then finally is an MX missile, all coming out of the male groin area. And the title on the work says Male Aggression Now Playing Everywhere. And I don't know if I want to discuss it more than that. It feels fairly obvious what I'm discussing, that the aggressive nature of the male and how, if it's taken to its extreme, can end up in these aggressive projectiles.
Well, I guess what I wanted to ask you, I got the impression that you thought of yourself as having a male half and a female half from the tug of war. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know what you thought of as being the characteristics of the male part and the characteristics of the female part.
Well, ultimately, I would like to think that they're not too different, that there's a blending of both in each of us, even though it might become clear that one of us is the male and one is the female, that we have both in us, and that I'm 51% male and 49% female, hence I've been ended up to be a male, and you're 51% female and 49% male, and that we have both in us. One is dominant and one is not dominant, To ask me to separate them out now is very dangerous territory for me to be in, because it only further divides what I feel is practically the same. There are traditional things that we attribute to the female, which are so-called intuition, feeling for the planet that doesn't seem to want to destroy life as much as the male who seems to. It's the males who are in the army. It's the males who seem to be doing the shooting. There aren't too many women who are building weapons to destroy. They seem to have a more intuitive life force more recessive, more, I'll get into such dangerous territory here because I don't want to even, you know, to do that. But at the same time, the males have a certain strength that is, they're physically a little larger, so they can lift heavier weights. Big deal, but that's it. You know, so you can do certain things. Women can do certain things. I feel they both have their strengths. Hence, we're both attracted to each other because one can do what the other can't do, and we get from the other one what we don't have ourselves. So there's the natural attraction to each other.
There's some, well, we mentioned the Hitler dream before. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you think growing up in 1942 that a lot of war imagery and other imagery from that period had a permanent effect on you visually.
I don't think so. Of course, I was born in 1942, so I hadn't. Then I began to grow up after that. I early visions of war don't really enter into my mentality. Although, frankly, as a child, I remember playing at war, like having a helmet and a fake gun, and playing out in the country there in the woods and throwing, grabbing, we call them dirt bombs, hunks of grass and that had dirt, clumps of grass, and throwing them over hills, trying to lob them into the other guys. Dirt bunker there and hit them on the head with their helmets. I mean, that sort of reflects to me sort of an ingrown male aggression that was probably there. It probably looked like fun to be at war or something. But I remember the Korean War striking me as a kind of scary thing, but I didn't know what it was. I don't remember being scared too much by the idea of war. I'm really more hurt by the idea, and always have been, that people are hitting each other, either in individuals or humanity. It's rather saddening to me more than frightening. Somehow I don't believe that we really have the capabilities to totally destroy ourselves. I believe positively that we'll solve the problem. In fact, we are in the process of it, and part of the process of solving the problem is coming directly to the issues at hand, and that's what we're doing right now politically, and we're talking about it, and certain people are yelling one way and certain another, but the fact is the issues are being very clearly laid out now. It costs this much to maintain an army. It costs the other side this much to maintain an army. We still have a certain amount of poor people on the planet, 6 million of them starving right now in Africa. There's a certain amount of logic that you can begin to apply to the way life is going and determine what's important and what isn't. And so I ultimately have faith that things will resolve themselves, although some days I feel less optimistic, I guess.
How do you think success is changing your art? I think you're becoming more self-conscious or anything, knowing that now when you doodle, you could put it up and sell it for hundreds of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure I'm becoming more self-conscious, and that can work positively and negatively. I think I can try to direct and make my work even more specific now that I have an apparent audience. It makes me feel like I can begin to say things I might not have said before, and people will listen, and I can, you know, I begin to gain a little power, it seems, by having an audience, and therefore I might speak out on certain things that I feel are important and I hope are important to other people. At the same time, it makes one a little reclusive, and you feel the dangers of putting yourself too much out in the open. Leaves you open to, once you've gained a certain amount of fame or whatever in your particular field, that also leaves you open to people taking pot shots at you or not liking your work, because if a large group of people are saying, "We really like that work, we really," then there's always going to be somebody stimulated to say, "Well, we hate that work, we hate that work, or we don't like that work." Whereas if nobody's saying it, then nobody's saying it either way, nobody pays attention. But once the work does gain some popularity, it's naturally going to stimulate some negative criticism. And then I have to learn as a normal human being to deal with negative criticism or incorrect criticism or, yes.
Your art is a lot about you. I mean, a lot of it's outward and it's political, but a lot of it is about you. Do you ever think that could get to the point where it's self-indulgent?
Mm-hmm. I just was asked that question at the Philadelphia College of Art about 2 hours ago, where I was talking to some students. My answer was something like this. It came out well before. I hope I can do it again. I feel that by studying myself, I have a connection to myself that nobody has except me, and I don't have really the same connection to you or anybody else. So there's a unique relationship that you have with yourself, in a sense. So it's something that can be developed. Like you can observe yourself in different situations. You know that some days you're happy and some days you're sad. Some days you're anxious. Some days you get a lot of good work done, other days not. Well, these are just things that interest me. How does it happen? Why? Is there a certain way that I can live my life that I'll be a more full person, a more productive person? So the goal would be to study oneself for those reasons. I would hope to not to become self-obsessed or egotistical just because I love myself, but to hopefully grow. And that means studying how I do things. If I happen to smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, I might want to question after a while, if I find out this is detrimental to my health, why I keep doing it. If, in fact, I know it's detrimental to my health, I might want to ask, what is it that's driving me to do this? That would be beneficial to me to find out. And then I might stop if I found out. Then, if I become a stronger person in myself, that will only reflect out onto the people I deal with, because, as you know, we pass energy off to each other every day. Hello, how you doing, Joe? I'm lousy again today. Well, Joe has just passed off some lousy energy to a friend, and now this friend is going to try to recoup his attack of lousy energy for a moment and go on. But or you can send off the best energy you have, and so if you've become a fuller human being, hopefully you can send out and give to people that which you're feeling. And if you're feeling terrible and your life is anxious, then you send out that anxiety. Hence, there's a good reason to study yourself and to find better ways to become a fuller person. So, number one, you don't injure other people with your anxiety attacks and your problems. And that if anything, you try to give out the best you can to those people you come in contact with in your work, whether you're in an office or wherever. You're constantly coming in contact with people, and we do pass to each other how our feelings.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
And I've been speaking with artist Jonathan Borofsky, and we've been discussing his work. He has an installation. It's a retrospective and installation that opens this Sunday at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and it will continue through December 2nd. After that, the show's going to travel to the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, the Corcoran Art Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. There's also a book about Borofsky that was written for this traveling exhibit by a Philadelphia Museum of Art curator and a curator from the Whitney Museum of Art. Again, the show from October 7th, this Sunday, through December 2nd, an installation and retrospective by Jonathan Borofsky, who now lives on the West Coast in the area of Venice, California, but grew up in Boston. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
It's a minute to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at five for tonight's edition of All Things Considered, and I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon. Make that Monday afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with shadow traffic.
Well, bumper to bumper driving for motorists traveling home on northbound I-95, a 35 to 40-minute delay from just over a mile approaching the Race Street merger through the Betsy Ross Bridge construction. Average speeds there 5 to 15 miles per hour. Southbound 95, you're going to find a 10 to 15-minute delay coming off the Girard Point Bridge into the airport area. The westbound Schuylkill Expressway also bumper to bumper from approaching University Avenue through Girard, and again from west of Montgomery Drive through the Boulevard crossover, about a 10-minute delay in that area. Then once again, bumper to bumper driving from west of Gulf Mills through Route 202. That's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
Shadow traffic report funded by White Glove Cellular Phones. If you're observing Yom Kippur tonight and tomorrow, I wish you a very good fast. That's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Jay Goldman with the technical director, Maeve McGoran, associate producer, Danny Miller, co-producer. I'm Terry Gross. Have a great weekend. This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia.
Support for local transmission of All Things Considered today is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Lynn Neary with All Things Considered. The bus stopped. Suddenly we saw this horde of white kids and parents. This lovely child picked up a brick and just lunged it right through the back of that bus. And to the cheers of the parents.
In Boston, in the fall of 1974, in the interest of integration, the busing of children, resulting in fear and anger and violence. Tonight, in All Things Considered, a report on the Boston schools 10 years after desegregation.
Also, the Space Shuttle Challenger, an on-time liftoff, and a busy crew of seven circling the Earth for more than a week.
An increase in murders in the prisons in Texas.